My awesome. Time. I have over an hour. I'm going to call the Mexican tax server.
Just remove this destination from the stream and then re-edit.
It's live.
Excellent.
Okay, perfect. All right. Welcome to ATL Alts. This is your host, Andre Sandate. I am joined today by two guests. My special guest, who I'm going to introduce first, is Ron Geffner, who is a founding partner of the executive committee of SATIS in New York City and also leads the financial services practice. Welcome to ATL Alts, Ron.
Thanks for having me, Andres.
And then I'm going to be trying a new concept today and co-hosting with a business partner of mine, Robert Swarthout, who's the founder, CEO, and portfolio manager of a crypto fund based in Atlanta as well called Teton Crypto Capital. So thanks for joining me today, Robert.
Yeah, thank you.
The show today, we're going to talk a lot about what is happening in the crypto and digital assets environment, Ron, and was really glad that we could get some time on your calendar. I know how busy you are and how important your time is. So thanks for joining me today. I'd love to start, though, with more of a human interest question. One of the things with the podcast and the guests that I've tried to bring on is to get a little bit more of their backstory. And we'll certainly dive into crypto and what's going on in the enforcement arena. I know you have that background with the SEC and all the stuff you're doing in fund formation across alternative investments. But before we do that, tell us a little bit about Ron Geffner and kind of how did you become a partner of a big, you know, firm in New York and get into this line of work?
Once again, thanks again for having me on. And Robert, yeah. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Yes.
So, child of immigrants, only person in my family born in the United States. I was always told that I spoke well, so my parents sort of guided me along with a very sharp stick going into law school. At law school, first time I actually really enjoyed the academics of that path because I finally saw the application of what I was learning to what I imagined myself doing. Through an on-campus interview, was hired by the SEC in their enforcement division. There were 2,000 applicants. Six of us were hired. And of the six of us, this is pre-Madoff, so nobody really knew much about the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. So mm-hmm. I was one of a handful of people at the SEC prosecuting violations of federal securities laws with a focus on the asset management industry.
Okay.
Went from there to PricewaterhouseCoopers, where I conducted mock reviews. Well, Pricewaterhouse. It wasn't Coopers by the time I got there. And yeah. then after two stints at different law firms and really debating on whether I wanted to practice law or go a different path, I chose to found with a few other gentlemen, Sadis and Goldberg.
Okay.
Where I've been for 27 years. On average, we launch about 60 to 80 private funds per year. So at this point, we represent over 1,000 funds. We're agnostic to investment strategy, launch size, location. So it's really been a phenomenal learning experience, which is really what I enjoy about my job, because
sure.
similar to many people listening and definitely to Robert and to you, I'm an entrepreneur, no different than you guys. So yeah. I knew what it was like to go home for about, I'd say 15 years, thinking I have to hold up like the out of business sign on my front door eventually and working at odd hours and responding to emails and texts and every other social media platform now instantaneously. And that has not changed. It's just been a part of my life, like the same way I wake up, no matter what time of day it is, no matter what time I go to sleep. Always yeah. a fun pain to share with other people. So, yeah. and then from that, it's really just grown. So we've been involved in the crypto space, or I have as well, in particular, since 08, in representing some of the earlier investors in Bitcoin, same way with cannabis. And I've also done venture capital investing the last 10 years in some of the emerging spaces,
yeah.
as well as all of the traditional. So it's really,
yeah.
it really has been a really rewarding seat to occupy in the marketplace. And while I sit in New York, I travel and I feel like a little bit of like a Woody Allen from a movie, Zelig, where no matter what city I go to, people assume I'm local to their city. Unless you're in the field and then you cringe when you see me.
Right. Get out of here, Ron. This is our backyard.
Yeah, what are you doing?
I'm based in Atlanta. That's the show ATL Alts. And you know, one of the things that's really cool about our industry is we can now connect through these mediums like podcasts and webinars and conferences. I remember when we first met, somebody said, "You got to get to know Geff." And I said, "Who's Geff? Like David Geffen? Like the media, the entertainment?" No, this is a different Geff. He's probably more important. And so I'm flattering you because I want to have fun on our show today.
Dante's in LA.
Yeah.
And not that I'm a giant, but I'm definitely taller than him.
Yeah. So this is a different Geff. So to those of you listening, Ron Geffner and I have known one another. Gosh, it's been 10 or 15 years, but we don't get to see each other as much. You're running around in those circles, like you mentioned, and I'm hunkered down trying to build my brand, ATL Alts, but gotten to know Robert, and you know, we are pretty deep in the weeds with crypto, and that was selfishly one of the things we wanted to talk about today. Some of my guests don't know Robert as well. We do a live show weekly on Wednesdays that we live stream to talk about crypto news, but I want to give Robert a chance to give a very brief intro as well so that we have some context before we jump into talking digital assets and what's going on in crypto.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, Andres. So I'm a software developer turned crypto fund manager. I've turned a passion that is, you know, researching and just learning about crypto since early 2018 into running a fund that focuses on commercial utility or tokens solving commercial utility. You know, it's a journey. This is going to be a long journey when it comes to the commercial side of things, but excited to kind of what the future holds. Looking forward to the conversation. Yeah.
Well, and I wanted to ask Robert to join us because, you know, we have some burning questions that we want to ask, you know, somebody like yourself, Ron, first of which is, I don't know if I want to use this word, but I'm gonna, because it's my show and I can. What the hell is the fund manager / crypto investor to think about the current enforcement environment around crypto in the U.S.?
Great question, because people don't frame it the way you're framing it.
Right.
And this is going to have a few faceted answers.
That's fine.
I'll start off with a positive answer. Uncertainty leads to alpha and opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I never thought about it until you framed the question that way. So while there is uncertainty to some degree on what is going on in the crypto space, that affords investors or traders and anybody else in between an opportunity to make money. When everything is clear sailing and you can chart it, it's much harder to distinguish yourself or opportunities from one another. So that would be the positive. What's being asked for those that are not as familiar with crypto is, how does US legislation and regulation look at cryptocurrencies? And can you determine uniformly how one should go about treating them? And the answer is, unfortunately, no. What's that debate is whether cryptocurrencies are a security for the most part, or a commodity, or something else. Crypto managers and people who tend to be pro-crypto take the position that cryptocurrencies are not a security, and that is a new asset class, and as a result requires new rules. The SEC is taking the position that the federal securities laws, in particular the Securities Act of 1933, based on its application, all cryptocurrencies should be deemed to be a security, with some of them that are something different would be considered a commodity under the Commodity Exchange Act. And therein lies the problem. The SEC is not implementing new rules to provide some interpretive guidance. They are speaking publicly, but they're acting by bringing actions in court.
Right.
And so that brings us to, when we go from the extreme worst, FTX, Binance, Coinbase, XRP/Ripple. And really at the heart of it is, there is a case that came out in 1946, I believe, SEC versus Howey, that is a seminal case in applying the law and determining whether an asset is a security or not. And SEC versus Howey is about, there were investment contracts for orange groves or citrus groves.
Yeah, yeah, the Howey test.
So you, it seems completely opposite to anything you might think of with crypto, but that's not necessarily the case. And so there, depending on how you read it, it can arguably be like three or four prongs in determining whether something is a security. First, if it's an investment of money in a common scheme with profits to be derived solely from the efforts of others.
Others, yeah.
That's, those are the magic words. So we can go and apply it. I don't want to go and make this a lectern for me to go and be professorial, but happy to frame. I'm just trying to give us the framework.
Yeah. But to your point earlier, look, this ATL Alt show is, there's three prongs, to use your word, to my show. One, well, four. We want to have fun and be candid. And the human aspect and the backstory. I want folks to feel like at the end of our 45, 50 minute conversation, they've gotten to know Robert better. They've gotten to know you better. Hopefully you guys, you know, feel like, you know, you can be candid on the show. But one of the things that I find with crypto and digital assets is, you know, you have the professional institutional kind of fund manager, and then you have retail investors increasingly, right, who can now get active in crypto via the new Bitcoin ETFs, which we could talk about. But on the show today, what I wanted to start with was that kind of tougher question for you, Ron, is getting your perspective as somebody who's worked with over 1,000 alternative fund managers, somebody that, you know, crypto is a space that I think you can make the argument is growing. I saw the prediction by Brad Garlinghouse that came out today that he thinks, this is the CEO of Ripple, he thinks that it's a $5 trillion market, you know, within a number of years, right? So with a T. So
but also keep in mind, I learned this the hard way from the VC investing side, and I'm not looking to supplant any of the clients that are professional asset managers.
Sure.
I might as well have gone to Atlantic City or Vegas. I prefer Vegas, they say. But one of the things I did learn is that the founder of businesses, they drink their own Kool-Aid. And even when they're telling you the truth, it's our job as investors or the public to really sort of determine whether they're objective, which they're not, and how biased are they.
They're not.
So I hear on the $5 trillion, it seems that crypto is growing. But it's anybody's.
But some of these rules from the 30s and 40s still apply, and we still have to apply these tests.
To a greater degree, those rules were, our country really nailed it on those rules. So many other countries have mimicked our federal securities laws. When I was at the SEC in 91, I specifically remember people from other parts of the world coming to understand how the SEC operates.
Mm-hmm.
The SEC's task is daunting.
Yeah, tough. Yeah, I mean, look, the next question I wanted to ask you, and then, you know, feel free to jump in, Robert, is when you think about America and the capital markets and the financial markets, right, we have historically been sort of the leaders, right? And that's when you talk about where should you set up your business, right? You incorporate in certain parts of the world and set up in certain parts of the world because we have case law, we have the courts, we have regulations. It does seem, though,
stability too.
Right. But it does seem like when it comes to crypto and digital assets, like when it comes to being a leader, the US, because of this enforcement environment, the regulatory uncertainty, isn't it fair to sort of have a conversation around our competitiveness, around innovation? And is that going to move offshore because of this uncertainty? And maybe the second follow-up is, what do we need to do if we all have a self-interest in having a competitive environment, having free markets, and having 2,000 clients, not 1,000, right? How do we support that? What does that look like? So those are kind of two questions.
So professionally, I perceive myself as a very competitive person.
I know that.
I'm all for being number one, but there are times when you rush into things, you can create more problems and kill an industry by being number one and then having the people that rely on your jurisdiction do it with regret. So it's really hard to build a reputation. It's easy to lose a reputation.
Sure.
So while I promote the idea of I want the US to be number one in everything, it's okay sometimes if we're number two or three. And looking at it from an American, the ugly American perspective, we have most of the money that seems to be going into the financial services industry to begin with, at least with regard to private funds. I feel that we are the bigger market than Europe. Ever since I've been practicing law, it's been more Europeans coming to the States to get to our investor assets and less of Americans going abroad to get to non-US assets. Not to say that there isn't significant money everywhere. So I think it's more about getting it right with the balance of don't let perfection prevent you from moving forward. So it's a balance.
Yeah.
So
do you feel like if there was a true balance there, there would be two-way communication with the SEC in the industry? Because it feels so one-sided right now.
It is, but I would also tell you, let's be fair, right? We live in a finger-pointing society where people don't want to take responsibility for their actions. Go back 10, 15 years, and I would tell you the industry itself bears blame. The industry, if you kept stomping on the ground saying this is new technology, this, you know, it's not your old dad's Chevrolet.
Yeah.
Rewrite rules, and basically they're giving the bird to the government. That's not the way you deal with regulators. Right. What they should have done, and maybe they did, maybe I'm not aware of this, they should have formed a coalition, went to explain what was going on, and worked together with regulators as opposed to saying, hey, old man, your rules don't apply to me. Go pound sand. I'm going to go off to this other jury. I'm going to go to the Bahamas.
Right.
Engage in my crime or wherever it might be. So it's not necessarily just the SEC's fault. And I'm not saying the SEC, like I get confused and I have not had the opportunity to speak to Gensler. And I don't know if things were taken out of context and I've seen videos. And I don't know what the state of mind was back in the time when he made these statements. Because data may have changed. But the part that was confusing was him being on video channels teaching and saying how crypto was not a security. And now, wait, you're at the helm of the SEC and you're taking the complete opposite view. I don't know if there's any interview out there that's really taken the time or whether he's been interested in addressing that inconsistency. And by the way, he's one person, but he is leading the ship, so to speak.
He's got a big microphone. Yes.
Yes. Even bigger than this one.
Yeah. Right. And mine. Well, look, we appreciate getting those kind of bigger questions on the table. I think it would be really, really cool to spend time also, you know, because we're talking to somebody like yourself as an entrepreneur, as a business owner that has this long history. You said 20 plus years, if I did the math correctly, over 1,200 funds and counting.
Yeah.
So you're seeing a lot of flow. You're seeing a lot of everything across the alternative landscape
on a global level.
Yeah. And I'd love to ask you, Ron, when it comes to crypto and digital assets, because there's been this wave of, you know, people are doing crypto, they're not, the FOMO, they're in, they're out. It does feel like now with these Bitcoin ETFs out there, prices have run up again in Bitcoin. We're not selling securities here. We're not giving advice, but people are talking about it more. When you go down to your practice level, and you don't have to name names, but I'd love to just generally get your thoughts. Maybe it's the whole industry. What are fund managers asking their law firms and their attorneys about crypto? If they're hedge funds and they're doing multi-strategy or they're doing, you know, global macro, like, are they active in this space from your sense? How are investors thinking about it?
So some global macro managers, their doc, and I would not know their portfolios. I just would know what was in their offering documents, have added disclosure at times that they may trade crypto securities. There were, if you went back a few years, was how did you access those markets? And many of those markets, due to regulatory uncertainty, sought to avoid, at least on paper, because when we go to Binance, on paper, they indicated, yo, you're an American, stay away. You're not supposed to trade through us. But I'm pretty sure, based on what I've read and based on what seems like common sense, when I say read in the public market, not private CIA file that I would have, that if you went through the efforts of saying you were not a US person or trading through an offshore account, that was all the diligence they did. And they would rely upon your representations and warranty, no matter how blatant the compliance with that rep was. So like I said, it goes back to everybody bears a little bit of blame in ruining the meal for the public. But the questions that come up, and it depends on the managers.
Sure, so they're all different.
Depends on the sophistication. Is can I custody my own assets? Where do I trade them through? Who should I use for an audit? It's a lot of the early stage managers. This is part of the transition as the industry has matured. The early stage managers, if you went to the late 2008 through 12, they were more of the crypto nerd, we'll say it, that they were tech geek. It was their language. And people were asking them to trade, and they did. They've never run a business, and they went out and they started opening up an account and commingling investors' money without proper documentation, just all putting it in one thing, and no common sense even applied to it. And now they had a mess, or you had fraud. Now the fraud, I'm not blaming on crypto, because it would be the same fraudsters that came about 20 years ago that claim to be hedge funds. Just because you claim to be a hedge fund, just because you claim to be investing in crypto and you're a bad person, that's not a reflection on crypto. It's the same thing going on right now with AI. People are making claims that they're using AI, or they're greenwashing things for ESG. You're going to have bad people on periphery. I'm not counting that. I'm discarding
that. Right. What you're saying is there was a generation of manager who started funds. They didn't have professional controls. They didn't have institutional controls, checks and balances, all the things. There was a lack of infrastructure and oversight. What are you seeing today? Then?
They ruined the party a little.
And they did. And to your point, you made that comment earlier. What are you seeing today? Or maybe
so today it's matured.
I'm assuming the client that comes to you is hearing something very different.
Yeah, they're more institutional these days. On average, we're getting younger, smaller entrants still, but they now seem to have enough humility to accept the fact that many of the old rules apply, and they realize that they don't want to get in trouble. Whatever that trouble is, which quite frankly, people can't fathom still, unless you've been in it. For anybody who hasn't been involved in a litigation, you don't want to be involved in a litigation.
Oh man, I can only imagine.
That's the advice I can give you.
Yeah. The headaches, the cost, et cetera. So it sounds to me like, Ron, are you somewhat spending time with, let's just say, a manager, an investment professional that comes in and says, hey, I have this idea. I want to set up or I want to start trading XYZ assets or instruments. Do you spend time being the lawyer and the business advisor coach? Because
I've always been the business advisor coach because one of the things that I believe separates or distinguishes me, and this is not a sales pitch, just is how I speak and how I dress. And anybody who really has taken the time to get to know me, I'm a businessman practicing law.
Accessibility.
It's whether it's about fees and liquidity to the naming of the product, to the vendor selection, to distribution agreements or engaging a third-party marketer or place an agent. And we also represent some very, 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 I can't even add enough, very wealthy family office investors and institutional investors. So we're really seeing the full gamut when it relates to the securities laws, commercial terms, tax issues, ERISA issues that arise. And then conversely, we're also dealing with SEC investigations in connection with crypto or in connection with running the asset management business and whether you properly stated your performance to disclosure of conflicts of interest, to things that a lot of the people in the emerging manager crypto space would not understand.
Yeah.
Because no one's taken the time and they certainly have not engaged with professionals that can guide them. And so what happened also in the crypto space, there were people that were looking for lawyers to guide them that were deep in crypto. But those people that were early days deep in crypto knew nothing about the asset management industry. So the manager not knowing that was hiring somebody. Yeah, you know how to do an ICO and you understand blockchain. Great. But if you don't understand the Investment Advisors Act, the Investment Company Act, the Internal Revenue Code, ERISA, that's the bigger problem. So while managers do care about litigation risk in making an allocation, it comes up less and less. That, frankly, came up much more in cannabis-related investments, where people would approach me and say, we want to do this on behalf of investors, or we want to raise money, but we don't know if we're going to be prosecuting. Can you give us comfort under the federal securities laws? And there I'd have to go and explain the Cole memo and how it's governed by state law. So with crypto, my experience has been that there's less of a concern on whether something's going to be deemed to be an unregistered security, because they already have access now to that data by going online and reading about it.
I want to ask you something that you said earlier. People that know you, people that have gotten to know you, they know the way you do business, the way you practice law is you're there. To me, that's one thing that has always made me want to, you know, recommend you call Ron. It's because you are a lawyer and an attorney and you know your shit, but you can talk to Ron. You can like actually get some counsel from Ron. I just have a question for all our lawyers maybe listening. When did you say, I'm just going to be Ron, and Ron's a good lawyer, but I'm not going to be the mumbo jumbo, you know, big shoe law firm, you know, personality? Because there's so much of that. And for younger managers thinking, I got to go hire a big name, big firm, blah, blah, blah. Otherwise, I won't raise a dollar. I won't be taken serious. When did you make that? Or were you always wrong? You know what I mean?
Yeah, you know what it is? The older I'm getting, the more true to myself I've become.
Yeah.
And when I was 30, like I started Sadus when I was 30. And I'm turning 58 in like less than 2 months, which is a little scary in and of itself. It's been an evolution. And when you're in your 30s, whether you may not be able to appreciate it, and it's a good thing. I'm not saying this is a bad thing.
Sure.
You have a lot of hubris. You have a lot of fire in the belly. And you have all these hormones still raging in your body that you don't appreciate. And if you're also running an emerging business, you have that fear that can paralyze you or motivate you. It can be designed in a way that, like for me, I would get into the office at 7:30. I did this for like 15 years. So I'm still evolving, because even on LinkedIn, my family's from Israel, not to get political, but I became more of an activist since October 7th. And not because I'm Jewish, but because I'm an American and I believe in democracy and I believe in respecting one another's differences. And I was living in a bubble and really blown away with how much anti-Semitism that I didn't realize existed, because I never experienced it. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's a great question that you ask, because I don't think people get it. I met with somebody who I've known for a while, and she was like, oh, you don't have to worry about making a living, and you have to have any fear, like people know who you are and going to hire you. I'm like, no, I'm doing this despite my fear. And so being myself, I'd rather have more meaningful, honest relationships with people. But there's been plenty of people I have a client who I'm really close with in Manhattan Beach. He would in California. He went to a dinner. There was a lawyer from another firm there, and the lawyer sits next to him. He starts bad-mouthing me at this dinner. My client gets up, moves to a different seat at the table. The guy follows him. And then, funny enough, about 3 months later, I'm on a panel with this lawyer. And I debated seriously on walking up to him, whispering in his ear, and say, hey, I heard what you did with so-and-so. I'm going to have a lot of fun here tonight. Now, that said, one of the other experiences I've been going through is not holding on to anger.
Yeah. And
I always still occasionally do. It's nothing like it was in my 30s and my early 40s, which has enabled me to then and not to become a finger pointer, which I also used to do, and accept responsibility for my actions and trying to really be honest with myself. So doing all of those things has enabled me, I think, to relate or connect with people more. And this is not a defensive commentary. While we're a law firm of 30 lawyers, our practice in Preqin in the private fund space and hedge funds in particular is ranked 3 in the United States and 7 in the world.
Yeah, so, I knew that you. Yeah. I mean, like I said, you guys have a very, very strong reputation. Like I said, we're in Atlanta. I want you to get down to Atlanta because I want you to see what's happening on the ground here. I'm trying to promote Atlanta. Robert knows this. Like, I'm a big long-term believer that this industry in the Southeast can grow, can flourish. New York will always be New York, San Francisco, places like Boston and Dallas. But the Southeast is growing. That doesn't mean by default the alternative investment industry should grow. It does mean, however, that there are a lot more people that are moving here, living here, have wealth, want to invest, want to get into alternatives, want to understand alternatives. And I wanted to build a business and a platform that could help educate, inform, and also inspire. And you can't educate and inform and inspire if you can't get the human side of things. So that's why I appreciate you answering, you know, some of those more human element aspects of the conversation. Talking about crypto, you know, when you think about where this industry is, you know, today you have meme coins. They're on fire. You look at AI. You mentioned AI. It's almost like if those were the securities, they're up 1,000, 1,400%, 400%. Things that actually enterprises are using, things that actually, you know, businesses and industry are using. It just seems like right now we're in this attention economy more so than a utility economy. And I'm just curious whether or not you invest in the space or you follow it, you know, as closely. But I'm just curious, do you think this is the first inning, to use the baseball analogy, of this whole thing? Or do you think, you know,
crypto, I feel like we're in the fifth inning.
Okay.
That based on my studies, and I'm not sure who, I'd like to reference whoever it is. I got the idea from, I honestly don't remember. It's certain industries go through growth, hyper growth, and then consolidation and then maturity. Yeah. So I feel like with crypto, we went through growth and then hyper growth. And now we're going through the consolidation and the cleaning of house. So you look at cases regarding Coinbase and Ripple and FTX and Binance, and you saw that certain celebrities or promoters have been fined. And we'll call that the lower level clarity that regulators are going about through enforcement creating. So I feel like we're getting close to being past a lot of it. And we now see institutional distribution of registered products with ETFs. So that to me would lead me to believe that we're going through the maturation stage now.
Okay.
And law is just one of those variables.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
And by the way, I've invested in years ago into a crypto infrastructure play with a few of my colleagues.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's the picks and shovels and the blockchain. And, you know, you hear a lot of people in crypto, like, say, well, I want to own the picks and shovels versus, you know, be the one, you know, trying to, you know, drill holes in the ground, that, you know, comparison to oil and gas or panning for gold. But Robert, I want to let you jump in here.
Yeah, you mentioned Coinbase. I'm curious, you know, they became public in early 21, right? The SEC that is suing them now is the one that approved the S-1, and they're suing them over that same S-1. Like, what are investors supposed to make of that? Like, it seems like an absolute mess.
Well, it's a great question, and I don't know if I have enough from my own education,
sure,
data to comment on the totality of the question.
Yep.
But in approving whether they go public, it's a function of a range of listing requirements under the laws.
Okay.
And as long as you're engaging in what is a legal business. Yep. So I don't necessarily equate the two in the way you're doing, but I understand why. I don't think it rose to the level. So the SEC, if you look at it on one level, that the SEC claims that every cryptocurrency is a security. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there were allegations that they brought against Coinbase on a number of assets that they were deemed to be securities, but all got dismissed but for two.
Right.
And you look at the fact that the SEC had an allegation that Coinbase was an unregistered broker dealer due to the wallet that they were utilizing, and that was dismissed.
Yes.
And so what is left are being an unregistered exchange, mm-hmm, and having two assets that were a security, and that's preceding the fact that motions to dismiss were denied. I don't view it as an SEC win, and one could argue it's a Coinbase win. Mm-hmm. But we're getting clarity, and it's similar across the board if you look at Binance and the same allegations. And right. What we are getting from the litigations is clarity on how one determines the SEC versus how we test. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at the coins ecosystem.
Right.
They're looking to see what the people that were originally supporting a coin, what they were doing in the marketplace, and how that affected how it should be determined to be, whether mm-hmm. it's a security or not. And it goes back to centralization, decentralization, mm-hmm. and whether it's really controlled by a handful of people. And I don't view the SEC's actions as a bad thing. I view it as a good thing, because I assume the two of you have been a party to, not from a liability, and I'm putting sure. that as a defendant.
Right.
But you've heard conversations where there are people out there promoting coins, and your instinct was, these are not good people.
Absolutely. You're, right.
They're just trying to promote it and manipulate it and get out. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at the rest of the public as dummies. Absolutely. So you need some enforcement to clear the riffraff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, conversely, I was on air waiting to go on CNBC with regard to Sam Bankman-Fried's sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
And I disagreed with Madoff's lawyer. I wasn't able to share my thoughts, where he says this would serve to influence people to not break the law. And that's not how I've seen criminals behave in conversations that I've had with the few that I've had the unfortunate encounter with. It wasn't like, oh, I could go to jail, then I'm not going to do this.
Yeah. It
was a slippery slope. I can make money. I'm going to do this and this and this. Oh, you're telling me I spent a year or two going down the wrong road because I didn't have the money to hire a good lawyer, or I didn't think twice. Yeah, you're an idiot. You got it wrong and I got it right.
Right.
And so that's starting to go away.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at the totality of the information in the marketplace, we're getting fewer calls of that nature. Mm-hmm. I've had any from people in that regard. And I view that as a good thing. Unfortunately, it's a price of an industry as it matures.
Yeah. I would say I genuinely agree with what you're saying around, it's a good thing. From my perspective, obviously a non-lawyer's perspective, I wish there was more of a dialogue that was happening, right? Like, it seems like come in and talk to us and then you leave with the subpoena on the way out.
And I understand it. It's having a measured, intelligent, and well-thought conversation,
right. But
also being balanced.
Mm-hmm.
Hey. If we in any industry are trying to sell something,
mm-hmm.
the person listening knows you're trying to sell them, and they don't listen. It's like yelling at your teenager.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you raise your voice, as soon as you lose your temper, just shut up. The conversation's over already.
Yeah.
Oh, they don't have to be a teenager. I coach youth baseball. My 9-year-old, he just tunes it out. I'm like, let's work on this with this. No, I don't want to hear it. And so you, as Steve Kerr says, if you're a parent and you have kids playing youth sports, just shut up.
It's a human condition. So that's really why when I've been going through my self-evaluation, it's the power of not having fear, despite being I suffer from fear because I'm human. If I didn't, I'd be a little afraid of who I'd be. But despite the fear, not being governed by it and having intelligent, calm conversation. And that applies to everything all of us are doing. And when we're dealing with the regulators, when we're dealing with investors, when we're dealing with our vendors,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I did earn my gray hair. This isn't like gray hair for men.
Yes.
When you started the interview, you said that the lack of enforcement or this uncertainty does create investment opportunity. So I'm going to kind of circle back to that theme. When we talk about digital assets, it can mean a lot of things, right? We have NFTs, we have DeFi, we have venture investments, we have tokens, all the, and everything in between, right? Whether this applies to crypto funds or just general funds, maybe a venture fund or private equity, when a group comes to you, Ron, and says, we have this investment strategy, these are the things we want to buy or sell or short, do you guide them to really narrow in or to take a wide sort of approach and say, we're going to try to put everything in the PPM and in the offering docs, right? Like, What's your sort of strategy and thinking around that?
Somewhere in between. So okay. To adequately guide you, offering documents should be updated ideally every 2-3 years at longest. So okay. The information you put in there as to your strategy probably evolves. So
sure.
if let's assume that is the case, because otherwise my answer would change. If you said you're going to write a placement memo and you're not touching it for 15 years, which obviously we would counsel against, my response is going to be different than if you're periodically going through it. So it's a balance of we try to advise our clients who want to come in with a very, very narrow strategy. Are you sure you're going to stick to that?
Mm.
So first and foremost, especially with crypto, we get into the conversation, are these going to be level 3 assets or liquid assets? Can they be more easily valued? It's going to influence.
Wait, back up. This is the education part. You just said level 3. I promised when I started this, my bill of rights was that, you know, we wouldn't use jargon. So tell us what level 3, level 2, level 1 is, liquid.
And that to some greater degree is not in my pay scale, but
I got you.
Level 3 is hard to value assets.
Okay. Hard to value.
It's more challenging and risky to confirm the valuation.
Okay. So they're not traded on the New York Stock
Exchange where there's such a heavy volume.
Got that it. You
can validate the price point. Where that becomes relevant, and if we go through the lessons of 2008, pre-2008, hedge funds were easy to market. Private equity and venture capital funds were harder to market because they have elongated investment cycles. So if you invested in a closed-end or private equity VC fund, your investment cycle might have been 7 to 10 years before you start seeing $1 back. Whereas a hedge fund, theoretically, you might have no lockup to an average of lockup of 1 to 2 years with redemption opportunity. So because of that lockup, people just started shoving everything into a hedge fund, not thinking there might someday be a run on the bank and you can't sell the assets that you invested in. Hence the dislocation of the types of assets and the liquidity features of the offering documents.
Mm.
So we go into crypto. You have assets that you may not be able to sell. If you're getting at early stages, hard to value. And every time money comes in or out of a hedge fund, you need to properly value, and the word properly is really important, the portfolio, because money coming in or out, if let's say Robert and I invested in your fund, Andres, and we put in $10,000 and we're fully invested and another investor wants to come in to the fund. If that if you need to now look, try to understand that $20,000 we invested, if you were to replicate the portfolio identically, really what would be the true cost or the true market value? So if you are too conservative and say, you know what, I'm going to value it at cost, even though it's probably worth more, you're harming Robert and I because you're diluting us at an unfair price.
Yeah.
Firstly, you overvalue it. You're harming the incoming investor and they're paying more for something that they really should be paying less for.
Yep.
So, separately, if now we have redemptions coming into the fund, knowing that we can pay the investor in a timely manner, we need to understand the liquidity features. A lot of times when people are coming to trade crypto, my ask is the majority of your assets going to be liquid or illiquid? And because people come to you with legal decisions made in their mind, not realizing that that's what they're doing. And I'll give you an example.
Mm.
I want to form a hedge fund. Now, do you know the difference between a hedge fund and a private equity fund when you're making that statement to me? You might have read it. You might have heard it from some bumbling fool at the pub.
Right.
Watched
too many episodes of Billions.
I mean, I watched 2 seasons of it. I did watch three bodies or something like that on Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just came out.
There's a lot of misunderstanding about what
so is part of being a good lawyer is educating your client.
Yeah.
While you're trying to avoid them commoditizing you.
Yeah.
It's very much a mutual educational process. And the better you get to know one another, the better guidance you're going to get.
Yeah, but you said something. Yeah, you said something very, very powerful, you know, for those listening that are thinking about or are already running a fund, a private fund, a platform properly. Valuing, right? So it's like you can have the great docs and the great like advice, but if you don't actually implement it or have it done per how it's written, you could be putting yourself, you know, you could have exposure, I guess, is really the takeaway.
But it's also a learning curve of things that you would not, you know, could happen, but you wouldn't know the likelihood. Give you an example. So Robert, you set up your first fund 2 years ago, right?
Correct.
So now let's say 10 years from now, you're running $1 billion in four different funds. And let's say you were to hire, you go back to your lawyer in a year and you say, look, I want to do a second fund, a second domestic fund.
Mm-hmm.
Now they may not realize this, but one of the thing processes I go through is, do I dumb down the new fund documents to match up identically with your other document? Because there's been developments. Do I just do it to the best of my ability under my current learning curve to today? Now there's some nuanced differences between fund one and fund two.
Mm-hmm.
I go with the most modern fund today for fund two, and we have to update fund one.
Mm-hmm.
How that plays into effect, I had a client set up four funds over 10 years. The valuation language to determine the net asset value of the portfolio evolved slowly over that 10-year period. So the difference is to the average person been like a word here, a word there.
It's meaningful. Yeah.
And the value was, I was on a call and I asked the administrator, please tell me you're using each fund documents to run the NAV for each fund's portfolio. Yeah, that should have been my reaction with like popcorn and like my feet on the desk.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up being they were applying the valuation from one set of fund documents to all the accounts.
Mm.
So they had to restate NAV. Same way without naming names, because you haven't mentioned your administrator on air, correct?
Correct.
So we'll say an administrator with a pretty identical name,
mm-hmm,
in connection with a redemption from investors. If you're running a hedge fund and I go to redeem from your fund, usually a certain percentage is held back until after an audit to make sure that you got the valuation right. Because if you overpay me on my way out, good luck getting the money back from me once I've gone to Barbados.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So that's called a holdback. In this situation, the administrator failed to segregate the holdback money from the invested money, mm-hmm, and the manager invested the money. It was at risk and lost it.
Oof.
Mm.
So over and over and over and over again, knowing somebody who's really knowledgeable about where the errors are made and who are the more reliable vendors in the marketplace versus the others, mm-hmm, it's ecosystem. Know the ecosystem, know the regulation. And it's not just about launching you with any of your vendors. It's these are your partners. If you don't approach it with their partners or they don't, it's mm-hmm not the right fit.
Yeah.
And especially with crypto, because it's evolving routinely still.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you know, just the idea of valuation, it's like, which crypto exchange are you looking at to value a token? Because it obviously can be different on all of them for the single trade.
By the way, if you approach it differently, depending on each position, mm-hmm, that's a mistake. If you come up with a procedure, then apply it across the board equally.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because that's another area of risk.
You know, one thing, Ron, I would love to finish on, ATL Alts is not exclusive just for funds and for those that want to set up a fund. It's also for investors, people that want to learn about alternatives, people that run a family office or sit at a desk at an allocator, where they can learn about new strategies. I'd love to ask you about the LP, the investor side of your practice. And as we wrap up, just ask you a couple of questions. You know, what are the things that LPs are asking you? Maybe not just about crypto, but private markets and all in general just exploded.
So what are the things that they're worried about? The LPs that hire us tend to be very sophisticated and have other teams of lawyers and consultants on the portfolio selection. So they're coming to us with more sophisticated questions. The tax effect. So if they're a non-US person, they don't want effectively connected income, ECI.
ECI, yeah.
To when they've come to us after they have invested, unfortunately, we turned Martin Scarelli, we filed a whistleblower complaint against Martin Scarelli, which is one of the reasons he went to jail. There we represented a family office, and there were concerns that they couldn't redeem their investments. So it depends on when the investor hires us or brings us in. We had a recent client who he himself has run multiple funds and has been a client of ours on and off for two decades. And he had us review offering documents of another fund just to assess the risks that we could have.
Yeah.
Based on the strategy, liquidity, structure of the fund, the asset class. Mm-hmm. So it really does vary. And it's the same way with every investment manager. Our job is to educate you so that you as a manager can make an informed decision. So by way of example, and I don't want to go into Robert's structuring because I don't want to put him on the spot. But in an ideal world, structuring a fund, you, domestically domiciled or domiciled offshore, we always advise that they create one entity to receive the management fee and a separate entity to receive the incentive or carry. And then we go into more nuanced guidance, depending on where they're domiciled, depending on the asset class, depending on their assets under management, on how to structure either the management entities or the funds, really driven by tax guidance. And then the regulatory guidance is a whole other skill set. Yeah. It really is not a one size fits all.
Right. There's so much, so much that goes into it. I want to also ask you, this question pertains to investors, but also to funds. We've seen an absolute explosion in the number of GP staked funds or platforms being set up by funds or family offices or LPs who want to buy stakes in other asset managers. Is that just me, what I'm reading, or is that a trend that we're seeing?
It's been around for a while.
Yeah.
Neuberger Berman had an interest in one, that Dial, which is fairly well known, that's been doing it. We are involved right now working with various large institutions about creating asset management platforms and a range of different variables and how that can be accomplished. Mm-hmm. I've spent 20 years working on seed deals, and a seed deal is when an investor allocates a certain amount, on average, money into portfolio capital in return for an interest in the management entity. Depending on time and history, sometimes it's been operational capital. Sometimes it's been back offices bartered for a an interest in the manager.
Maybe to pick up on that, because I think that was an area where we met way back in 2010, 2012. What is the state of the seeding business today? Are there firms that do this? Is it family offices? Are these other hedge funds? It seems
it's all the above.
Is it?
We just worked on a transaction with two different clients of ours. So they signed a conflict waiver in which one client was allocating something in return for an interest in the manager. So that was a PM of another asset management firm. We've also done seed deals recently where there are institutional seeders that on average, the rule of thumb of what I've seen for them is they allocate $100 million in portfolio capital and they recycle it in 2 or 3 years. There's a lockup of those assets. And then after they redeem their assets, they historically maintain the interest in the asset manager, regardless. So pre-08, the cards were more in favor of the asset manager negotiating the terms. Post-08 and the financial crisis, it became more in favor of the seeder, the terms of the deal. And I'm really curious if and when the cycle turns.
Yeah.
And that really drew from the fact that post-08 and the financial crisis, from what I'm reading, I don't know this to be true by looking through the data, 90% of the money went to the 10% of the largest fund managers in the marketplace, leaving the other 90% of the population of fund managers to fight over 10% of the assets. So the emerging manager industry has really been harmed or under stress.
Yeah. It's clearly challenging out there for the new launch and the startup manager to attract capital. So this is my last question for you, Ron. When an aspiring manager comes to you and is seeking counsel and wants to get educated, you just outlined a couple of different options: seeding program, a stakes program. Maybe they want to set up their own fund to go try to raise capital. What are some of the just honest questions if it's your nephew and they want to go set a fund up? What are some of the honest questions that they need to ask themselves before they jump into this? you know,
the big one is people, a lot of emerging managers, I understand where they come from because I've started my own business from scratch. When I started Sadus, to put in perspective, I only had $30,000 in business. And my ex-wife was home with my twins that were 6 months old. And I had a mortgage and maybe $10,000 in the bank. That's some pretty scary, sobering data, which is why I work the hours that I work. But it's trying to make decisions that are not fear-based. So a lot of times I'll meet managers, and many of them it's solely price point. I'm not saying price point does not play a role, but really is when they commoditize their vendors, most likely they're going to get commoditized in return. And it's not just launching the product. It's being there to guide you where I'm not learning on your nickel most of the times. It's very, very rare. It's first blush we are seeing it based on the team that we have here. And so we can give measured guidance that more likely than not, it's accurate. And that's not just, I'm not talking about legal guidance, I'm talking about business guidance. And I've seen what works. Doesn't mean I have a book on it, doesn't mean there's not other good law firms. Doesn't mean that we 100% know there's no person batting a thousand. If they are, then we can pretty much be certain that they're honest. So I think that's the biggest mistake, or that people don't do their homework. And we're living in that like TikTok Insta society where if it's more than 20 seconds, you've lost the person's attention span. So if you're being a PM, conversely, it's you're solely limiting yourself to working with the biggest of players, you may not get really good attention.
Yeah.
Even if you launch with $100 to $200 million, you're gonna be small fish for your vendor. So my advice is work with people you relate to, that speak the language, are good at their craft, that you feel is equally appreciated, and you're as equally appreciative of their being at the table with you.
It's wise advice. Wise advice. Robert, I'll go to you. Do you have any final questions or takes before we wrap up this conversation with Ron today?
No, I really appreciated hearing his viewpoint. I mean, don't often get to sit and talk to an attorney for an hour and not have to pay for it. So
you can get an invoice. Do not get me out of that opportunity, please.
Don't let him off the hook yet.
You logged in, that was an implicit engagement.
That's right. Ron, you know, Geffner, you're the guy that I model trying to get on the show, right? Having conversation, being candid, obviously getting somebody that's highly informed, seeing lots of volume, lots of flow. I know how busy you are, so I want to thank you for taking time today to join us on ATLLs.
Well, first of all, thank you for the opportunity, and two, congrats on your success. And three, it's always great to see you.
Yeah, likewise. I look forward to seeing you in New York on the next trip, and I want to get you down here to Atlanta soon.
You let me know when you want me to come to Atlanta. I'm always happy to go there. It's awesome. Been a little while.
Yeah, we'd love to have you. All right, folks, that's our show for today. Ron Geffner. With Sadus, Robert Swarthout with Teton Crypto Capital. This is Andres, your host with ATL Alts and Endurance. Thanks for joining us today.
Take care.